So we were wrapping up Prakim Lamed to Lamed Bet, 30 to 32. And I had a vision in my mind that we would do this, you know, Perek Lamed Gimel, chapter 33 as well. And wrap that and even start talking about 34, 35, as I said in my initial email. And then when I got into Perek Lamed Gimel, there is so much going on there. It's beautiful. And I don't want to stint on it. I think there's a lot that's worth seeing. So we're going to start with our conclusion of chapters 30 to 32. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, take a look at 1007. We'll be somewhere around there, and then to spend the rest of the time on Perek Lamed Gimel, chapter 33. We'll see how far we get within that. That's the last of the hoys. Right? Remember what these hoys are about. This was after Yeshaya talked about a future reward and punishment for the nations and an ultimate redemption. We then have these six declarations of Hoy, in which we started with chapters 28 and 29 talking about a warning to Judea, to Yehuda, that they should not indulge, they should not be decadent. They've been scorning the messages of the Nevi'im, of the prophets, and turning on Hashem. But punishment is coming before there will be a redemption. Then you had Prakim Lamed to Lamed Bet, which were about not putting your faith in Egypt, in the alliances that you make. You should pursue justice, and if you are complacent, if you're decadent, that will be punished. That was this piece in chapters 30 and 32, which were the fourth and fifth of the hoys. So last time we talked about turning to Egypt for support, the whole issue of turning to Egypt for support in general in Tanakh, and specifically as Yeshaya sees it here. Yeshaya, who has a problem with alliances in general, let alone an alliance with Mitzrayim. And then we talked about the collateral damage involved in seeking an alliance with Egypt. The undermining of the relationship with the Navi, with the prophet. You didn't ask the Navi for permission, was one point that was stressed. You told the Navi, if anything, to be quiet. You rejected his message. Another theme, which I want to come back to in chapter 33, it'll be relevant there, was the theme of churning versus faith. How you make these attempts to try to create your own Yeshua, your own salvation, instead of relying on Hashem. And that was something we talked about back in chapter 22, with the defenses of Yerushalayim. We talked about whether Yeshaya is against practical steps, and we said he's not. But what he is against is practical steps that come without the Emunah in Hashem, without this confidence that Hashem is going to take care of us. And so we were told in chapter 30 that when you have shuva vanachat, when you have tranquility, when you rely on Hashem, that's when your salvation will come. Or as we read it in the commentators, when you rely on Hashem, your salvation will come easily and peacefully. And then the other major theme that we saw in the section was ge'ulah, the redemption. We had some discussion about whether this means the redemption from the Assyrians, or whether this is meant to be about the time of Mashiach, and we talked about the sun and the moon increasing in their radiance. And I'm not going through all the different pieces that we talked about, but we had Assyria falling with music, and we talked about what that music might be, the music of the Chayot, which goes back to the Gemara. Was it talking about the idea that that there is joy when the wicked collapse? But ultimately, when redemption comes, then chapters 28 and 29, the mocking of the prophets, will be reversed, and all the losses will be reversed. There will be education in place of the ignorance and inability to learn. Now they will be able to. Now they will be able to learn. And then finally, in chapter 32, we had more of a rebuke for those who are self-indulgent, and the statement in conclusion, don't worry, redemption is coming. So the last bit that we were doing here in chapter 32 was looking at the fun and interesting language that Yeshaya uses. So we started on that last time, and I'm not going to go through all of that again, but I wanted to note for you some other pieces that we didn't get to last time. So take a look at chapter 30, sentence 20, please, page 1005. Where we are told about this time of redemption, V'layikanef od morecha, your more, which we'll translate as teacher for now, will no longer be hidden from you, like kanaf. He will not be hidden by the garment from you. And instead, v'hayu einecha ro'os es morecha. Your eyes will see your more. So the question is, what exactly is this talking about? So Radak says you've got it all wrong. Radak says the word more is like yore umalkosh. It's rain. Your rain will not be gathered in. Instead, you will actually see the rain. That's Radak, and nobody else, but it's Radak. Usually it's taken, no, it means your instructor. So the Gemara in Sota, which I brought you in source number one, Rabbi Avo is talking about the reward given to the righteous, and Rabbi Avo, Omer Masbien Osomi Ziva Shechina. A righteous person will be fed from the radiance of the Shechina. As it says, your eyes will see your moreh. There is some splendor of God that you will perceive. God is your instructor. That's the way that the Gemara in Sota reads it. That's the way Rashi reads it here. Whereas Ibn Ezra, Radak, and similarly in Abarbanel say no. This is talking about the reversal of their refusal to learn. You refuse to learn from the prophets. You refuse to learn from the instructors back in chapters 28, 29. Now you're willing to learn. V'hayu einecha ro'os es morecha. You will get to see your mentors, your human mentors. It's not talking about God. And the Gemara does this, has this read and applies it in other circumstances. I brought you in source number two and in source number three, just because it's such a classic line. You know, you're familiar with the practice that people have, not only Lubavitchers and followers of the Baba Sali, of hanging pictures of their Rebbe, right? In the restaurant, in the house, wherever it is. The slogan that's quoted to explain that is "Va'yu'einecha ro'os es morecha." You should see your moreh. So some take that as because it's a reminder to you, like behave. You know, they're up there. And maybe that's part of the value. But the idea here is that it's not a warning. It's actually a prediction of reward. It's going to be a good thing. You will see your moreh, and that will benefit you. Not that it's something that's meant to keep you in line, but rather something that is meant to be a positive experience. So I brought you two Gemaras on this. One is number. The sukkah signs where you have pictures of Rebbeim. Okay. Okay. Well, they've got it in the house, so they're good. They take a look at number two. That's very interesting. Probably because they sit in the sukkah when it rains.
No,
they do.
No, at all.
Yeah. Really? That's really interesting. I'd like to know about that.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's supposed to be very simple. It's not supposed to be. You're supposed to know you're outside.
Interesting. Because the whole trend, going back to the Gemara, is to dafka decorate it. So I'm really curious as to what that's about. Okay. Source number two, Rebbe said, I am sharper than my peers, which he was, right? Rebbe Yehuda Anasi, canonizer of the Mishnah, political as well as scholarly leader of the Jews of his day, the early 3rd century Common Era. He says, you want to know why I'm sharper than others? Because I saw Rabbi Meir from behind him. That in and of itself was enough to somehow influence me. And had I seen him from in front of him, I would have been even sharper. What do you mean? You will see your moreh, and it will be an influence for you. And Rav Masharshia, in source number three, a sage from the time of the Gemara, gives advice to his kids about how they learn. And he says, first of all, prepare the material in advance. He says, when you're going to go learn, review the text of the Mishnah first before you go to your Rebbe. And when you're sitting there, watch their mouths. There's some kind of educational benefit to this. So I thought that was really interesting and worth highlighting. Another line from this parak that's an important line is sentence 33 in this parak. So it's the top of page 1007. Ki aruch me esmul tafte, For prepared from yesterday, don't be bothered by the esmul as opposed to esmol. Commentators take it as the same thing. But prepared since yesterday was taftet. So taftet they translate here as hell. They don't bother to say gehinom, which is interesting. The Ibn Ezra says it's a filthy place outside of Yerushalayim. However, the commentators tend to take it as the Gemara in Erevin does, which I brought you in source number 5, that it's talking about Gehinom. It's talking about hell. That's the idea here. And it was Aruch Me Esmul. It was prepared from yesterday, meaning before creation. Where do you get before creation? Because it was a day that had a yesterday and not a day before that. That's the way that that Rashi explains it. A day that only had a yesterday. So, sorry, it's not before creation. It's day 2 of creation, is what Rashi says. A day that had a yesterday, but nothing more than that. The Gemara says that it's before creation. It's the Gemara in source number 4. We've talked about this Gemara before, that says that there are 7 things created before the universe. Right? We talked once about how Radak says that means that these are things that are fundamental to God's vision of the universe. Without them, the universe can't exist. So one of them, unfortunately, is Gehinom. That's this idea that it was created before. And if you look at number 5, the Gemara in Erevin says it has 3 entrances. One in the wilderness, one in the sea, and one in Yerushalayim. Those are the 3 places, and they're all based on psukim. They're all based on verses. But Yerushalayim is apparently one of them. There's an entrance for it there, which is based on, if you jump to chapter 31, sentence 9, is that the one I wanted? Oh, I know. I jumped in my Tanakh. Sorry. Yes. 31 sentence 9, which describes God as having Ur Lo B'Tzion. He has a fire ready in Zion. The Tanur Lo B'Yerushalayim, and an oven in Jerusalem. So they take that as a reference to this place, Taftet. The fire of punishment is there in Yerushalayim. Abar Benel has a much nicer read of what it means that God has a fire and an oven in Yerushalayim. If you take a look at number 6, he says it means that God lives there. Your oven, your fire, it's the place where you live. Such that when Sancheriv invaded, Hashem said, "Hey, this is my house." You know, he says to Sancheriv, "Get out of my house." That's the vision here, which is a lot more positive, I think, on the whole. But I found that to be also a line that's worth recognizing. 2 more. Chapter 32, sentence 17, gets used very interestingly in the Gemara. This is one for the fundraisers. Chapter 32, sentence 17, page 1009. V'hayam ma'asei hatzidakah shalom, v'avodas hatzidakah hashket v'vetach ad olam. So they translate here as the product of righteousness shall be peace, the effect of righteousness will be quiet and security forever. So they're doing 2 things. Number 1, they're taking tzedakah to mean righteousness, which is a legitimate translation for sure. And number 2, they're saying maaseh is the product of the tzedakah. So the product of righteousness will be shalom, and it will lead to peace, tranquility forever. Not a bad thing. I'm good with that. However, the Gemara says no. Tzedakah means tzedakah. It means what we think of as tzedakah. Philanthropy, helping people. Number 1. Number 2, ma'aseh, it distinguishes between the ma'aseh and the oseh. Oseh is one who does. Ma'aseh is one who gets others to do. So take a look now at your sheet at source number 7. Amar Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar said, "Gadol hame'aseh yoser min ha'oseh." It is greater to get other people to give tzedakah than to give it yourself. because it looks at the psukim about the reward for tzedakah, and it looks at the pasuk here, which it sees as presenting the reward for getting others to give tzedakah, and says, the reward here is greater. Clearly, it is even greater to get somebody else to give tzedakah. And when you think about it, why should that be the case? What's the logic behind it?
There's greater humility in the person who collects the tzedakah.
Humility in being the one who collects it? Why?
Because you have to humble yourself. At the end of the day, no matter how much money from whatever philanthropist, you have to humble yourself to get that money.
Okay, so there's the effect, the humbling that you have to do in order to ask. That's fair.
But I think also you, because it isn't just one person doing this ask of tzedakah, you are encouraging, you are helping other people do mitzvot. And so you are initiated.
Right. Right. So to add to what Rebecca is saying, and I'll take the other comments as well, but if you give the tzedakah, right, if you see the need,
then
the... Yes. Right. But the point is that you're, number one, you're making sure the need is taken care of, which you do when you give also. But number two, you're getting other people engaged and involved in a mitzvah. So you've now helped the recipient, obviously, but you've also helped all those people who contributed, and therefore there's value. I saw other hands on this, Jane. You were going to say?
Just that you're also giving them, you're giving them a mitzvah and you're doing a mitzvah.
Correct. Right. Yeah. Louise?
Well, Moish said humility and made me think that, well, you're kind of invisible. You're getting other people to give, but it's, you're not really taking the credit, and you're not getting kavod, but all these other people are. You're doing a mitzvah and everything, but you're not in the public.
Right. The tzedakah collector tends not to get the headlines in a positive way.
But
that's the truth. I mean, we all know that people complain about the organizations that are collecting tzedakah. That's the truth of it. I knew all about the organizations that are the umbrella organizations that collect tzedakah before I even knew what they did, just because I heard the way people talked about them. That's the reality. As a kid, you hear you hear that.
There's one other thing that, and I don't know how much people realize it. There's a whole change that's not going to last 20, 30 years. That there used to be causes or foundations that you gave to. But now the plethora is huge. And everybody is being chased by hospitals. And there's just so many causes. And the whole idea of give to UGA because it supports the schools and people is no longer true. And half the time, what the collectors are doing is they have to get the philanthropists to stay there.
Right.
Rather than go to, another place, that is just good.
Right. And this was, I gave a shiur last week about the issue of educated tzedakah and priorities in tzedakah, and the tension of giving directly, which has the advantage of seeing the need yourself and being inspired for that, which is very important, and it develops a person's mercy when they actually see the need themselves. But on the other hand, being an expert in terms of knowing what the needs actually are and having done the vetting work and being able to tell is something that requires devotion of time and development of expertise, for which an umbrella organization becomes really important. Not to mention, if people are just going to give where they want, the end result is that the less attractive causes will be neglected, or the ones that can't speak loudest, or the ones that can't sell themselves well will be ignored. It's another point behind the idea of having the umbrella as opposed to the earmarked or targeted type of a gift. I think there's more to be said, but this is certainly true. And it's true, it's for sure true that it's developed a lot more in recent decades. Okay, the last piece on this is chapter 32, sentence 20. The very last sentence. So again, page 1009. Ashrechem zorei al kol mayim mishalchei regel hashor v'hachamor. Are they translated here? You will be so fortunate to sow upon all waters, sending the ox and the donkey to roam freely. In this time of redemption, it's going to be wonderful. You will have freedom. You can plant on all waters. It's great. It sounds good to me, at any rate. They take a look, please, at source number 8. We translated this already last week when we saw the pasuk. We said Rashi and Abarbanel rendered it as "you planted righteousness." Zor'el kolmayim, you planted righteousness. Whereas Radak and Malbim said, "No, it's a promise. Wherever you plant, you'll find water." But take a look at number 8, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. What is the meaning of, and they quote our pasuk, Israel is fortunate when they're involved in Torah and acts of generosity, then nature is in their control, and their nature is in their control, and they are not in the control of their nature. What are you talking about? Planting upon all waters, refers to tzedakah. And they quote you a pasuk from Hosea to that effect, that planting is talking about giving tzedakah. And water is, of course, Torah. So you plant tzedakah, you are engaged in Torah, and when you do that, you send the leg of the ox and donkey, says the Medrash here, was taught in the Yeshiva of Eliyahu, you should make yourself like the ox to the yoke and the donkey to the burden for words of Torah. You become a beast of burden, effectively. And when you do that, Ashrechem, you are indeed fortunate, and as the Gemara says, then your Yetzer, your nature, your inclination will be in your control. So all of these things are just, because I felt like you can't do these prakim, these chapters, and not notice the import of some of the verses that are used beyond the context in Yeshaya, but they have applications elsewhere. Okay.